Introducing Sri Kunja Swami, one of the very early devotees who is still with us at the ashram, is Sri Kunja Swami. You know, he didn't die until, I don't think, 95, and this is like 66.
Oh, still there, they say, in the ashram.
He's from Kerala. He was attending the Bhagavan for some time. Most of the attendants were like brahmacharis from Kerala.
Yeah.
Most of them, for some reason, you know, he used to say that. Oh, there's a few others. You should read his life story in the book.
I read Reminiscence of
Kunja Swami. Yeah. Oh, he was a disciple of that guy who was going to do Jivan Mukta. He was going to do what? Jiva Samadhi. Put himself in the cave and tomb, you know, like Yaneshwar.
Yeah.
Did you read that part?
I don't remember that part.
How long ago you read it?
Last year.
One of the very early devotees who was still with us at the ashram is Sri Kunja Swami. He came as early as 1919, at the age of 18, when Bhagavan was still living at Skanda Ashram. Born at Kudambur near Palghat in Kerala. That's, you know, near the border somewhat, right? Palghat. Mm. So a lot of people, they know both Tamil and Malayalam, you know. He came of a family that were not vegetarians, but such was his aversion for meat eating that his whole family became vegetarian under his influence. You know, Balavat's family also, they used to eat birds,
and
maybe fish,
mm-hmm.
in Bihar. But then his older brother became vegetarian, which he was like 20 years older, 15 years older than him.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, everyone became vegetarian, I think, something like that. It was all about it. They're all, you know, strong Rama Bhaktas. You know, they're from Mithila. Mithila is where Sita's from. You know. And so, they recite Ramayana all the time, be going on. Okay. Even his older brother, you know, he can't hardly walk, but he's laying in bed reciting the Ramayana, looking on a cot, you know, on a veranda. An astrologer foretold that he would follow a spiritual course of life. In youth, he was already strongly drawn to japa and worship, and his parents, far from objecting, introduced him to a sannyasin from the Tamil land. This guru gave him a little kunja, milith kevelya, a text in Advaita. Gave him a little book, I guess. That's what they're saying. Although they called him Kunja because he was small.
He wasn't later on. He was big. Oh yeah.
Yeah, he got tall.
I don't know. He must have been thin. You know,
yeah, maybe so.
He also taught him breath control and other yogic practices, but the youth was not satisfied with this. Asked him if there was not any great one who had actually experience of Advaita. The sannyasin showed him a photo of Bhagavan and said that he lived at Arunachala. Kunja Swami determined to seek him out. It was a big story, you know, but he became a disciple of that Mother Swami, and he was going to go to Devi Samadhi. And a certain day he announced he's going to go into this tomb, and they're going to close the tomb.
Yes.
But he chickened out in the end.
Yeah, and he ran away.
There was a big crowd there, and everything out of the police and everything. And then by the time he's supposed to come in, he just disappeared in the crowd, yeah. You know.
Yeah, no show. And then he came back after many, many years again.
He reached the neighboring station of Katpadi with only 5 rupees in hand. This would have been enough for a ticket to Tiruvannamalai, but none were being issued, as there was plague there. He managed to reach Tiruvannamalai, but found it deserted. He spent the night in one of the mantapams on the route round the hill. So the train arrived at night. No one's supposed to get off, you know what I mean? Because they had the plague there. But someone told him, just get off. You know, it's going to just slow down there. Just get off. So someone else got off. Same time, it was all dark and everything. So he just followed that other person. Mm. Walked behind him, you know. Mm. And he ended up sleeping in some dharmasala or something, somewhere. Because it was dark when he arrived. And the plague opened up. He spent the night in one of the mantapams on the route around the hill. In the morning he climbed the hill to the hut where the Mudaliar Pati and her husband lived and used to cook food for Bhagavan. And they showed him the path to Skandashram. He did not know how to greet the saints. But seeing 3 others prostrating before him, he did too. It so happened that one of them, who came from Kerala, knew Kunjaswami and introduced him as a good youth and a spiritual aspirant. Bhagavan said nothing but nodded, as if in approval. Now, it wasn't a coincidence that Ramaswami, his name was Ramaswami also. They were friends in both sadhakas, and he couldn't go because he was obliged to that other Swami who's going to do the Jiva Samadhi. He said, you go ahead and find out, you know what I mean? So he went ahead. Kunja Swami sat for a long while in Bhagavan's presence. Bhagavan's mother and younger brother Narendranath Swami were also there. But Narendranath Swami was not yet the Sarvadhikari. Rumal Swami was then running the ashram. You know, Bhagavan told Narendranath, his brother, he should go into town and beg his food. Mm-hmm. That's good for your sadhana.
Not him.
Yeah, him.
Okay.
When he came. You know, his wife had died, he had only one son.
Oh.
And this is the only descendant from the family, Bhagavan's family.
Oh.
But one son.
Yeah.
But he had 7 children, so he made up for everyone. And he was the president of the ashram, T.M. Venkataraman. This is the present president's father.
Okay.
When the others had dispersed, Kunja Swami saw Bhagavan cooking something over a small charcoal stove. Imagine it must be some magic brew, which would give him moksha if he could partake of it. Before long, however, Bhagavan went out and brought back 4 puppies, to which he gave it. Unable to hold them all at once, he said to Kunju, hold them and let them go one by one. These were the first words Bhagavan ever spoke to Kunju, who accordingly took them as upadesa. In the evening, seeing Bhagavan clean up the place after the pups, he offered to do the work and was allowed to do it. Swamiswami approached Bhagavan alone and asked him for upadesa. Bhagavan's reply was that everything is upadesa and everything is grace. Kundaswami told Bhagavan that he was doing japa of Panchakshari, you know what mantra, that's Om Namah Shivaya. Oh. Five letters. Om Namah Shivaya. And asked for further guidance. Bhagavan told him to continue the japa as a form of dhyana. He did so for a few days and felt an extraordinary peace of mind. This led him to suppose that he could continue the dhyana as well in his native place. So he returned home. Well, he felt that too, and also that he shouldn't be taking food without doing service. You know what I mean? He felt guilty for taking. So both him and his friend, they both went back home. They both felt the same. However, the peace of mind evaporated, so he came back and decided this time to remain permanently with Bhagavan. In those days it was necessary to have permission from Purumal Swami to stay in the ashram. And he gave Kundaswami permission for 1 week only. By Bhagavan's grace, however, Purumal Swami had to go away unexpectedly and entrusted Kundaswami with the task, which he himself usually performed, of massaging Bhagavan's feet in the evening with oil and warm water. Making this task his own, Kundaswami thus became a permanent resident. When Bhagavan's mother was on her deathbed, Kundaswami and Niranjananda Swami were in constant attendance on her. Since Niranjananda Swami had other work to do, the duty fell more on Kundaswami. During her last days, Bhagavan did not come to her, but only made inquiries about her health. On her last day, however, he sat with her the whole time, as has been related in the lives of him that have been written. The mother's body was buried at the foot of the hill, where the ashram now stands, so that pujas could be performed there. The residents of Skandashram now split into two. You know, he was one. He helped carry the body down from Skandashram to where the ashram is now.
That was before the steps and everything were leveled, right?
Yeah, that was. But there was sort of some sort of path there.
Yeah.
But you can see it's between two spots, you know what I mean? It's a natural way of going up there. The larger group staying with Bhagavan at Skandashram and the smaller remaining near the Mother Samadhi. One morning, Kundaswami was cleaning the vessel in a small stream near the Mother Samadhi when he heard a voice behind him. "I am a pilgrim. Where can I obtain food?" He turned round to see who it was, and who should it be but Bhagavan himself. Kundaswami and others requested Bhagavan to remain there, and so it came about. And the famous occasion when thieves broke into the ashram, Kundaswami was one of those in the hall with Bhagavan. Unable to put up with the rudeness and violence of the thieves and Bhagavan's extraordinary patience, he ran into town to get help and to inform the police. Many other anecdotes and stories about Bhagavan can be gathered from this old devotee. Later, you know, he dictated that story, which is in the book, The Reminiscences of Kundaswami.
Mm. He dictated it to you, right?
No, it was Balarmani, but he dictated to some, you know, he would be dictating to me in Tamil or
Mariam. Oh, he was dictating.
We always had to have a translator when we went
there. Yeah.
I went with them to, you know, Bhagavan's birthplace. Oh. Me, Bhagavat, and Kainitation. You know Kainitation.
Yeah.
So he was our translator, Kainitation.
Right, yeah, same thing.
But he was, he got a little perturbed because we were always asking Kundaswami questions. He had to be just the translator. He was also with Bhagavan at Kainitation. Getting used to these glasses, you know, it's a thing.
Lynn said in hers there's not very much reading space.
Yeah.
Oh.
It says, I have recently, this is a letter to the other, started to practice self-inquiry, and I've also become a vegetarian. Can you please tell me whether the Maharshi considered eggs to be sattvic food? This guy's name is Stephen Brody from Wembley. Must be British.
Yeah.
I read your journal avidly, and am especially interested in the stories about Bhagavan by those that knew him, and news of devotees, as I feel one reading them in intimacy with members of Bhagavan's family, and encouragement on the path. Editor. In that case, you will be enjoying the January issue, which is entirely about Bhagavan. As to vegetarianism, one does imbibe the subtle qualities of the food one eats, and pure or sattvic food is more conducive to the quest. There was an article on this subject in our issue of April 1964. Eggs are not sattvic and are not used at the ashram and were not in Bhagavan's lifetime. There is no great harm in eating them occasionally or in cakes and so on. Now that's Arthur Osborne's opinion.
Oh, okay. I'm okay with that.
No, but they used to say, Bhagavan, well, the eggs, if they're not fertilized, there's no life in them. You know what I mean? It's not potent. Bhagavan said, dope. He said, no, there's no, it's not alive, you know, like an animal, but he said it's potential life.
Yeah, it prevented it from being alive.
Well, that's a Britisher asking, you know, he's finding to another Britisher. A lot of ads. He went around and collected people to get them to contribute for the Kainitation. He was a managing editor, so he went around to get the compliments of Automobile Products of India Limited, Bombay. He went around to all these.
Bombay.
He spent a lot. You know, there's a lot of rich, well-to-do people in Bombay, so he used to spend a lot of time going there to get them to put ads in this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not like anybody reads the thing they're going to be interested in those items that they're advertising, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, steel
like
tools
steel,
and things like that.
Factory equipment.
Yeah. You know, Metaclade, automatic oil fuse switches, non-automatic oil.
Lots of hardware. Never know, Dennis.
This is the editorial of July 1966, on reincarnation. It is possible to discuss rebirth only from the point of view of ignorance, because from the point of view of knowledge, there is no one to be reborn. Therefore, Bhagavan would generally brush the question aside when asked about it. Although he did mention it often, you know, and which you could tell, you know, something he believed in, or he knew what would happen. Therefore, Bhagavan would generally brush aside the question when asked about it, He would make some such reply as, first find out whether you are born now, before asking whether you will be born, reborn. Or, why worry what you will be after death before you know what you are now? The one thing that a man is absolutely certain about is his own existence. He may come to believe that the world outside him is real or unreal, that he is sitting at a solid table, as his senses tell him, or at a cluster of whirling electrons, as the nuclear scientists tell him, that there is or is not a God, that other people readily exist, or that they are imagined by him, like the equally real-seeming people he saw in last night's dream. But what he knows from personal first-hand experience is his own existence. However, from this certainty, he makes a wholly unwarranted deduction that he is a limited individual being, identical with or located in a particular psychosomatic instrument. Therefore, he starts to worry what will happen to his hypothetical individual with this hypothetical individual when, at death, the psychosomatic instrument dissolves. Will it continue to exist without a body? Or will it get an ethereal in place of a physical body? Or will it take form as a new complex in a new physical body? It is no use asking the jnani, the enlightened, since he knows that these are unreal questions, inasmuch as the hypothetical individual about whom they are asked never really existed. This unreality of the hypothetical individual is the basic doctrine of anatta, no ego, which forms the very starting point of Buddhism. Its final realization is the culmination of all religion. A religion like Christianity, which does not say outright that the ego does not exist and never has, comes round to the same point by insisting that it must be sacrificed. He who gives up his life, the hypothetical ego, for Christ's sake shall find it, the true universal life of the Spirit. Whereas he who clings to it shall lose it, said Christ. But to give it up is the hardest thing to do, even though one may be convinced theoretically of its unreality. A man clings so tenaciously to the false hypotheses of individual being that the religions have to lead him by all manner of devious ways to weaken it, attack it, cut away its roots of desire, curb its exuberant growth or indulgence. Ways of indulging it are called vices and banned. Ways of curbing it are called virtues and extolled. Indeed, the one thing on which all religions agree is the need to discipline or deny it. And it may be that the common feature in all who renounce religion is its indulgence, or, to use the fashionable term of today, its expression. This preoccupation with the hypothetical individual has even invaded religion, taking the form of wondering what will happen to it after death. Indeed, for many people, religion has come to mean mainly beliefs and opinions as to what happens after death. Really, this is an insignificant part of religion. It may be seen from the fact that two of the world's great religions, Judaism and the original Taoism, said nothing at all about it. That's why the Jews, they tried to make the best of this life because they don't have any theology about afterlife. In Judaism, there's nothing.
Oh, so, but they say when the Messiah comes, right? But he hasn't come yet.
Yeah.
They believe the Messiah.
Yeah.
The Christians believe the Messiah was
dead. Yeah, that the Jews missed their chance.
Yeah, yeah.
The modern exaggeration of its importance is a symptom of dangerous spiritual passivity, since by it religion comes to mean what will happen to me instead of what I have to achieve. As one of our contributors aptly remarked, nothing happens that is not earned, and what is earned can be earned as well before death as after. The act of dying will not of itself destroy the ego illusion. It is not the body that is the obstacle to nirvana or realization, whichever one may call it, but only the I am the body idea. That is why Bhagavan could affirm that there is no difference between realization in the body and realization after the death of the body. If the ego illusion remains to the end of life, death will not destroy it. On the other hand, if it is already liquidated, death will not revive it. Since it is only the hypothetical individual or illusory ego that can undergo reincarnation, the question exists, as I have already said, only from the point of view of ignorance. That does not, however, imply that it is completely invalid, inasmuch as posthumous states of being, although no more real than this life, are also no less real. It is best to wake up from the whole series of dreams, but for those who are unable to do so, it is possible to describe their sequence. Nor is doing this a mere concession to curiosity. It has a positive value within its limited range of reality, since the dream sequence, as long as it lasts, is shaped by the law of cause and effect, that is, of karma. And it is salutary for people to understand that what they do in this life shapes what they will be and undergo later. It is generally agreed in the various religions that those who have failed to awaken to reality pass on from this life to a subtle state in which they reap the harvest of good or ill that they have sown. The impressions preserved in what the psychologists would call the subconscious arise to form the environment and substance of a new world, just as they may during a dream. This is what is called heaven and hell. Hindu teachers add, however, that this is not the end. How can it be? How can an individual state of reaping the harvest of a phenomenal life be frozen into perpetuity? After having thus enjoyed or suffered what has been accumulated, the person is born again into a new life, starting at the level to which he had risen or fallen in his previous one. And in this new life, again, a harvest will be sown and will later have to be reaped. The question of time, of how long the subtle state between a death and a new birth lasts, does not necessarily arise, since time is only a condition of the physical life. Even during this life, it is possible during ecstasy or samadhi to experience timelessness. Moreover, dreams can skip about regardless of time. A dream may show the conditions of life of last week or of next week, and another of 10 years ago or 20. There is no necessary time sequence between them. Similarly, the duration of a subtle state between a death and a birth would be quite independent of the physical time scale. And on its termination, the next birth, like a person's next dream in this life, might take place at any point in the time scale. There may be cases where, owing to some contingency, rebirth will closely follow death by worldly time, but it may be possible for a man's next birth to be situated at any time, earlier or later. Just as his next dream can be concerned with any period of his life. A man who dies in England today may be reborn in Rome at the next time of Caesar. But what is definite is that he will be born in the conditions which his living has made appropriate for him. That is to say that it is definite so long as the dream sequence continues and the law of karma applies. It is generally said that there is no more rebirth for him who has awakened out of the dream of individual being into the reality of universal being. But it is never satisfactory to believe something just because it is generally said. That leads to arguments about doctrine. It is better to understand why it is said. In the vast tapestry of manifestation, the entire universe issues forth into form. Alternating, it is reabsorbed into formlessness. Each individual life can be likened to a thread in the tapestry. So if a person could see the whole chain of his incarnations, some of which, from the point where he stands, would appear to be casually past and others casually future, it would be as though one thread in the tapestry was lit up for him, and he would say, "Look, here it comes up again, and here, and here, and here." Once it might be brightly colored, and once murky, to one pattern central, and to another peripheral, and yet weaving its own pattern of successive appearances as it ran from one general pattern to another according to the scheme of development. Indeed, there is a twofold pattern of manifestation. The pure being, which in essence you are, is manifested horizontally and vertically through space and time. Horizontally takes form as all the other beings of your present world, vertically as all the past and future incarnations of your present person. You stand at the intersection of the two patterns. But when a man has realized his identity with the one being, which is manifested in this entire panorama, and which reabsorbs it, when even in this lifetime he has ceased to consider the body he wears his, or to suffer its destiny, it is similarly impossible for him to consider any other body or lifetime his in any other generation or world appearance. I say other rather than future, for the word future would reintroduce the idea of temporal succession and causation, which he has transcended. So far as he can be said to be embodied, it is by the entire universe, since he is identical with the one self which this shows forth. He may look at other appearances of the thread in the world tapestry which his body is, and say, "I." He may say that it has been or will be or has performed some function or will do so, but all this is from the point of view of onlookers. And if he also says that he has no incarnation, present or future, or that the whole world is his incarnation, there is no contradiction. What has to be remembered is that a man does not become free from reincarnation at the moment of realization, but realizes that he was never bound by it. It is not as though one thread of the tapestry was cut and was therefore absent from future patterns, but as though the entire tapestry was lit up instead of just one thread. There's a quote from Sri Rona Maharshi, "Sleep is intermediate between two waking states. And in the same way, death is intermediate between two births." Bhagavan and reincarnation. This is called from talks with Sri Rona Maharshi in the teaching of Rona Maharshi in his own words. These are all Bhagavan sayings. "Just as rivers lose their individuality when they discharge their waters into the ocean, and yet the waters evaporate and return as rain on the hills, and back again through the rivers to the ocean, so also individuals lose their individuality when they go to sleep, but return again according to their previous innate tendency. Similarly, in death also, being is not lost. See how a tree grows again when its branches are cut off. So long as the life source is not destroyed, it will grow. Similarly, latent potentialities withdraw into the heart at death, but do not perish. That is how beings are reborn. In truth, however, there is neither seed nor tree. There is only being. Question: how long is the interval between death and rebirth? Bhagavan: it may be long or short, but a realized man undergoes no such change. He merges into the infinite being. As is said in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, some say that those who, after death, take the path of light are not reborn, whereas those who take the path of darkness are reborn after they have reaped their karma in their subtle bodies. If a man's merits and demerits are equal, he is reborn immediately on earth. If the merits outweigh the demerits, his subtle body goes first to heaven, while if the demerits outweigh the merits, he goes first to hell. But in either case, he is later reborn on earth. All this is described in the scriptures, but in fact there is neither birth nor death. One simply remains what one really is. That is the only truth. Question: in the Buddha's view that there is no continuous entity, answering to the idea of the individual soul, is this right or not? Is this consistent with the Hindu doctrine of a reincarnating ego? Is the soul a continuous entity which reincarnates again and again according to the Hindu doctrine, or a mere conglomeration of mental tendencies according to the Buddhist? Bhagavan: the real self is continuous and unaffected. The reincarnating ego belongs to the lower plane, that of thought. It is transcended by self-realization. Reincarnations are due to a spurious offshoot of being and are therefore denied by the Buddhist. The human state is due to a mingling of the sentient and the insentient. The birth of the I thought is a person's birth, and its death is his death. After the I thought has arisen, the false identification with the body arises. But if you cease to identify yourself with the body and realize the true self, this confusion will vanish. Devotee: even if I cannot realize in my lifetime, let me at least not forget on my deathbed. Let me have a glimpse of reality at the moment of death, so that it may stand me good stead in the future. Bhagavan: it is said in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, that whatever is a person's last thought at death determines his next birth. But it is necessary to experience reality now, in this lifetime, in order to experience it at death. Consider whether the present moment is any different from the last one of death, and try to be in the desired state now. Question. Is the Hindu doctrine of reincarnation right? Bhagavan. No definite answer is possible. Even the present incarnation is denied, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita. Question. Isn't your personality beginningless? Isn't our personality beginningless? Bhagavan. Find out first whether it exists at all. And after you have solved that problem, ask the question. Namalvar says, in ignorance, I took the ego to be the self. But with right knowledge, the ego is not, and only you remain as the self. Both the non-dualist and the dualist agree on the necessity for self-realization. Attain that first, and then raise other questions. Non-dualism or dualism cannot be decided on theoretical grounds alone. If the self is revealed, the question will not arise. Whatever is born must die. Whatever is acquired must be lost. But were you born? You are eternally existence. The self can never be lost. Okay. Here's a short poem. The Dream Self by A. Rao. You dreamed you were a postman, say, last night. And do you ask today if he still is? The postman, you, who never really was, but only seemed to be. It is so plain to see. What was he then? Had he a self, a soul? Or was he just a mask you took? And was the dream, with all the dream folk he found real, a world no further true than the mind of you, than in the mind of you? Why cling in vain to such a phantom self within the brief horizons of a dream? An intuition of eternity. Right, but whose? The dreams? What is, or what just seems? Put that ice on your window? On your car?
But it is 23 degrees.
Yeah, 25 here.
Did you wear a fat coat?
Oh, yeah. Long one. Mm-hmm.
Is it windy too?
Yeah.
That's worse.
It's cold. But there's no frost. I don't know why.
It wasn't humid enough yesterday.
Sure, yeah.